This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Ingrid E. Newkirk, co-founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, the largest animal rights organization in the world. Ingrid has spoken internationally on animal rights issues from the steps of the Canadian Parliament to the streets of New Delhi, India, where she spent her childhood. Her books include Save the Animals, 101 Easy Things You Can Do, and the PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights. Ingrid Newkirk is here today to tell us about progress in animal rights and to discuss how our relationship with animals can best evolve in the future. Welcome, Ingrid.
Thank you, Diane. Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Why was PETA founded? What is the history?
Well, I, like many people, grew up caring about animals, abhorring cruelty to animals, but I didn't realize back then, and I'm 64 and a half, when I was growing up, we ate animals as well. I certainly got fur and leather. I got my first fur coat when I was 19. I went fishing with my father and all sorts of things like that. So we compartmentalized our interest and our respect for animals. We would never countenance anyone kicking the dog. Really detested fox hunting. I grew up partially in England. But we didn't think about those other uses and abuses of animals. So when I grew up and I had a number of experiences, each one a learning experience that opened my eyes to some sort of cruelty, in farming, in the laboratory, I became a laboratory inspector, and that was really an eye-opener. And I became a law enforcement officer and actually went out on a farming call where some people had abandoned animals on a farm. And I saw for myself in all these instances that animals suffer very, very much when they're really ignored by people and we just see their bits. We see their bits hanging up on a rack in a clothing store or under plastic in a supermarket, and we don't think twice about it. So I made the decision that if I cared about animals and didn't know, that I might want to look into what the alternatives to eating and wearing animals and testing cosmetics and what have you on them and entertaining yourself with them. So I did. I did the homework, formed a small group. We were just five to begin with, and went out to try to talk to other people who cared about animals, didn't like cruelty, and say, hang on a minute. There are other ways in which you can help. It doesn't do any good, really, to give a small check or even a large check to a humane society or an animal welfare group once a year if every day you're going to the drugstore, the grocery store, you're buying shoes and what have you that come about as a direct result of cruelty. So you can scrap the check that you're writing, please don't, but you could, and instead not spend those thousands of dollars on things that directly harm animals in ways you may not see. You're not likely to go behind the scenes as I did, but choose things that are kind choices. Making kind choices was the theme of the group back in 1980 when we started, and it still is today.
What are the goals of PETA?
It's really to get respect for the others who happen not to be like us. It's an extension of what children should be taught in school, which is that it doesn't really matter what package an individual comes in. It's really not relevant what their skin color or gender or religion, and for us, what their species may be. It's that they all, these individuals, feel pain. You burn anyone, any individual with a cigarette, and they're going to be in pain. All of them want to live. They all love. They are all lonely. They all experience joy. And it's just really prejudice that has kept us from extending consideration to others. Used to be women got short shrift. Some still do in other parts of the world. People with disabilities were disregarded, even institutionalized. And we've done atrocious things in human history that all came about because of discrimination, because of feeling superior to everyone else. And animal rights is just an extension of that idea that the package doesn't matter. It's who's inside and what their basic interests are. And that includes, of course, respect And sometimes the greatest respect is just to leave them in peace.
In your view, what progress has been made in animal rights in the past 50 years?
Well, I first have to say there was an awful lot of progress to be made when we started, and there still is. It's not as if you have, I don't want to use the word luxury, but I will, the luxury of having one area in which animals are abused. It runs the gamut. You know, you have rodeos and elephants shackled in the circus and orcas put in marine amusement parks, and then animals used for their skin. Even their skin is taken from them. Babies taken away from their mothers, hunting lodges set up for so-called sport. It really is, it covers everything. And of course, everyone knows today factory farming, the industrialized production of animals as if they were inanimate, is a horror. So there was a long way to go, but we have made significant progress. When Peter started in 1980, I think there were two places where you could actually buy a shampoo that wasn't tested in a rabbit's eyes. And today there are about, 1,000 or so places, including big companies. There wasn't faux fur, really. That hadn't come on the market, or pleather instead of leather. People didn't have the selections. There was no soy milk or almond milk in the grocery store. And children had to dissect. They had to cut up the frog or the cat's or cow's eye. And of course, now they have choice because we have passed these policies in school districts and even in state law, where you can object to dissection and you can have a much more humane and educational experience in school. So a lot has changed. We have stopped many experiments by exposing them as completely cruel and worthless. For example, General Motors was the last car company to use baboons and pigs in these steering wheel crash tests. And all the car companies used them at one time, and we campaigned, were successful, and now you see the mannequins on television, and that's because they've stopped using animals. So progress, yes, and a lot of progress left to go.
How have our assumptions about animals and our view of animal rights changed over time, in your view?
Oh, I can see it very clearly, being of this wise old age of 64 and a half. Because when I was growing up, my parents loved animals, but it had a different meaning. And the phrase animal rights didn't exist, of course, until the late 60s, early 70s, when Peter Singer wrote this marvelous book called Animal Liberation, which certainly changed my perspective back then. But I think we have changed a lot, and you can see that in the media, you can see it in people's attitudes. Part of it, we have to give credit to people like Dr. Jane Goodall, Dr. Baruti Galdakas, who studied the orangutans, Diane Fossey with the great apes, Jacques Cousteau, because these people opened up our eyes to the behaviors of animals, that they weren't automatons, they weren't battery-operated toys. They had thoughts, they had feelings, they had reflection. And it's hard now for anyone to pretend that they don't know that animals are feeling. And yet back then, you had ivory ornamentation everywhere. Now we have Mr. Obama saying, let's burn the ivory, let's stop the trade. Everything. A woman's success was measured in whether or not she had done well enough to get a fur coat, often with the tail, the paws, and the head of the animal still stuck on the neck piece. All that's changed, and now that's not what people growing up want. That's not their sign of success. They want to get away from all that stuff. So we've learned a lot.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ingrid E. Newkirk, co-founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. Our topic is animal rights, and you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How would you characterize the overall approach of PETA in addressing animal rights?
It's changed a lot because society has changed. And I regret to say that today's culture is very focused on celebrity, it's focused on violence, and it's focused on sex. And when I say violence, I mean confrontation. Every year, it seems, it gets worse. You used to be able to debate things sensibly and put out a lot of facts and have people mull them over and actually have discourse. But those kinds of conversations are few and far between now. What you have is Twitter with 140 characters. You have the web, you have blogs competing, and you have a lot of hype. It's very hard to boil down a social issue into a few words for a soundbite. You really need to be able to explain and persuade and offer options and talk things out, especially when people might get defensive if you're not talking about something like, as Greenpeace did in the early days, talking about whaling in Japan or Russia. Everyone could get on board with that if they were in the United States or Europe and say, oh, yes, that shouldn't happen. But at PETA, we're talking about what's in our closets. What are in our bathroom cabinets? What is in our refrigerator? It's very personal. And so, of course, very not unexpectedly, people might bristle a little bit and say, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. We've always done that. And then our job is to say, well, yes, we have. But today we know this about animals, that about animals. We have options. May I show you? But it's very hard to condense that. So we find ourselves often in the position of having to use gimmickry, having to use sexualized advertising, and having to very quickly grab people's attention in the hope that when we grab it, for whatever reason, they will then perhaps come to PETA.org, the website, and see something more. Perhaps they'll watch a little film, or they'll learn 10 reasons that it's good for the earth to be vegetarian, or anything at all that they weren't expecting when they got that little soundbite.
What is your evidence that this type of approach seems to work?
It's very clear, actually. It's quite trackable because you can track how many people come to your website, how long they stay there, how many are unique visits, how many watch the videos, and how many download them, how many pass them on to their friends, and how many people actually perhaps sign a petition or send a letter to their member of Congress. All this is very measurable, and it does work.
What do you consider the key accomplishments of PETA?
I think changing hearts and minds. Again, that's not a very exciting thing to say, and perhaps something like switching the pigs and baboons for mannequins is more visually interesting. But I believe youth, the fact that, you know, with the old environmental movement, it was the young people who moved their parents and moved their teachers. They are the ones who learned about hardwoods, and they learned about water pollution and so on. And they taught us. And what we have today, which is very encouraging, is PETA has the biggest youth movement of any social activity group in the world. And we have young people who do not want to hurt animals in any way, and they are gung-ho. We have a college vegan cookbook, the skateboarders, the music festivals, all the things where young people hang out. They have a very strong animal rights presence, and they are going to drive the market. They're the ones who say, I would rather have this versus that. And that's a wonderful thing.
What do you consider to be the key animal rights issues at present?
Oh, there are so many, unfortunately. I certainly think that before I die, unless I step out of here and get run over by a bus, that elephants have to come out of the circus and wild animals have to come out of the circus, like tigers that are dragged around in these cages. And that orcas and dolphins have to come out of these aquarium amusement parks. Wild animals belong in their homelands or their home seas. They belong in the oceans, they belong in the jungles and in the woods and forests. They have their own social order. They do not belong in a cement bathtub. What it is to them is the size of a bathtub. Or performing stupid tricks. Or in the case of elephants, they really shouldn't be dominated. They shouldn't be shackled in the basement of an arena somewhere and hit with this fireplace poker-like thing called the bullhook so that they'll stand on their heads. You know, in the wild, I hate to call it the wild, but in their homelands, in Africa, in India, in Asia, generally, elephants are wonderful social animals. They're so incredibly intelligent. And the mothers and the aunts and the sisters will all stay together, and a female elephant will never leave the side of these other females for life. And yet you get something like Ringling Brothers or Carson and Barnes, and they take the babies away when they're a year or so. We have the photos, we have the video. You can see it on the website. They will remove these babies from their loving mothers. The babies panic. And then they tie them down by all fours and beat them into submission until they learn this is what you must do. And it's so unnatural for them. They don't understand why they should stand on their heads or raise this leg or raise their trunks. It absolutely goes against everything that's normal for them. And yet they are beaten down into submission and their whole life is just going from place to place in the railroad cars, in the shackles, standing in their own waste, doing the tricks. And it's just wrong. And that all has to go. But that's just one of the things we're working on.
Would you like to mention some other issues that you work on?
I'd be delighted. One of the things we're working on is getting vegan meals, which is going very successfully, into the schools because the kids want vegan meal lines, they want vegan meal plans, and they want vegan meals. And it's wonderful for them, too, because unlike my generation, most of us grew up, you know, with meat, potatoes, and a vegetable on the side. And my generation suffers from hardened arteries, heart attack, diabetes, stroke, overweight. These kids are going to be far healthier, but also they're doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it because they know that meat production and dairy production, too, are environmentally destructive. So we see this marvelous change that's happening in the schools. We're working on clothing issues very hard. We've just exposed in China, where most of Angora comes from, the fact that rabbits are live plucked. And rabbits scream. It's very, very disturbing to watch the films. We've shown the films to retailers. And I'm happy to say again that because consumers demanded this of retailers, retailers are pulling the Angora. We also, of course, we've been on the cattle drives. India, people find this hard to imagine because they think of India as a place of sacred cows. But it's a fact that Indian cows are slaughtered. It's just that people there don't eat the flesh. And the leather is sent over to Europe and to the United States, to North America. And that leather comprises a lot of what we see in the shops. And the suffering of those cattle is intense. Their journeys in the heat and the dust, tied together with nose ropes, noses bleeding, falling down. You know, we don't need any of this. So we show people, we say, look, if you buy that leather jacket or that leather sofa, this is what you're supporting. And you don't want to do that, do you? Here are the options. Choose something that doesn't have an animal attached to it, and the animals will be better off and you'll be happier.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Ingrid Newkirk, co-founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. Our topic is animal rights. How does having pets or companion animals fit into animal rights? What is your view?
Well, I've written a book about dogs, and I've written one about cats, and the one that was the funnest to write really was Let's Have a Dog Party. And I wrote it at the time when you saw people like Paris Hilton and Britney Spears getting dogs as if they were sort of arm candy. They were accoutrements to their nightlife lifestyle. And they dragged them into, you know, discotheques and who knows what. And I thought, this is not how dogs should be treated, really. They're not little toys. They're thinking, feeling individuals. So I wrote this book in an upbeat way to say, well, if you're getting a dog, here are the things to know. From an animal rights, or from a PETA, I should say, perspective, the key issues are, please don't breed your dog or cat. Please go to the shelter, not the breeder. Because if you go to the breeder, that perpetuates this homelessness cycle of more and more animals being born and nowhere for them all to go. So if you go to the shelter, you're saving a life. And we say, if you have the time, because animals require time. They're like children if you do it properly. They need to be looked at and looked after. If you have the patience, the understanding, the money, because veterinary care isn't cheap, and you are really going to respect them, have a symbiotic relationship there where you have the patience to take them out, you don't hurry them on their walk, and so on, and you get them sterilized, please go and get two. Don't get one, get two. And then they'll keep each other company when you're off to work or school or out at the movies.
Is it fair to keep animals as pets?
Today, I think it very much is, because the shelters are bursting with them and there's nowhere to put them. But having an animal, of course, is a lifetime commitment of that animal. They may live 8, 12, 15, maybe 18 years. I had a little dachshund who lived to be 17 and a little mixed chihuahua who lived to be almost 18. And when they get old, they require extra care. That's something I see where people say, oh, he's just old. And he's not just old. It's with old age, as I age, I know. With old age, you know, your eyesight might get dimmer and your gait might get slower and your back might hurt once in a while. They need to have extra care, not to just have us say, oh, they're getting old, but to really make sure they're getting things for their joints, and that they're comfortable, that they're up off the ground, that they're not exposed to drafts, that they're not hurried along, that they're given time, and so on. So it does require a big commitment. But if we're not just going to become a blur in that dog or cat's life, where we dash in, shove the food down, and dash out again, then yes, it could be lovely for them and very, very nice for us.
Would you comment on the issue of keeping dogs and cats indoors versus outdoors?
Well, I work all winter long, and Peter does, in some impoverished areas of North Carolina and Lower Virginia. And what we see with dogs kept outside is dogs kept on chains, and they're out in all weather, and people tend to be huddled around the fire or the central heating in their own home, and there's this poor shivering dog outside. So we deliver straw for their dog houses. We deliver dog houses because often they may just have a barrel, a metal barrel or something up against the fence. And I can tell you from looking at them and knowing that if you take them off that chain or you open the door, they want nothing more than to be in the warmth and to be with you. So if you have a cat, I say get a harness and go outside. Spend the time and let your cat sniff around outside. But don't let your cat out unattended, because we have predators, human and foxes and other things who are out for your cat. Traffic. Predation is one thing, traffic's another. Disease. If they catch a bird or a mouse, they can get toxoplasmosis or something else from them, or tapeworms or what have you. It's not safe outside in a built-up society for a dog or a cat or a toddler. So keep them all inside. Go out supervised walks. Take them to the park if they're dogs. Have a wonderful time. Take them camping and kayaking, all those things. But inside with you is where they belong when you're there.
What is your view of no-kill shelters?
I think it's marvelous if anybody takes in one or two or 20, if they can do it properly. But I think this buzz phrase of no kill is very damaging, because what it does is really cast a bad way of looking at the open admission shelters. If you have a shelter and you say it's going to be no kill, pretty soon you find, as somebody I know who runs one in Palm Beach said, 9,000 animals won't come in, they have nowhere to go, but you only can find homes for 200. So if you run a no-kill place, your options are very limited. You have to close the door. And then what becomes of those others? There isn't a magic wand which makes them suddenly disappear. They're abandoned, or they are tied up, or they're abused, or they're dumped outside the shelter. Things happen to them that are not nice, or they continue breeding and making more. So awful choices have to be made in a world where it's so easy to get hold of a dog or a cat, and there are so few laws, in fact, often none, that require that you sterilize them so that they don't keep producing. And what we find with no-kill shelters is often they restrict the hours, they charge money for intake, they don't impose any conditions for homes. So you find animals going into hoarders' basements. We had an awful case in Texas where these foster homes were taking animals because they didn't want the shelter to kill them. And over 100 cats were in one house and kept in individual carriers. The house caught on fire. The carriers were plastic. And every one of those cats died with the plastic melting in their carrier. I think no-kill promotes hoarding, it promotes absolute lack of standards, and it ignores the fact that something has to be done, and no one has come up with anything better to do other than to hold animals who are unwanted in your arms and let them slip away, not knowing that they're not going to wake up again.
How can our relationship with animals best evolve in the future? What steps should we take?
I think it's really important to talk to children, because they should grow up with this idea that nonviolence is a virtue. Kindness, of course, is a virtue. And these shouldn't be words. They should be imparted to them as deeds. And so that business of making kind choices, I think, is key. That we teach children and we act ourselves as if every decision we make in life can have an impact, because it can. But from an animal rights perspective, it's really just look at your buying choices. That's the key. Look at what you buy. And if there's an animal attached to it in any way, don't do it. Just get away from it.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Please go to our website. And I say that because not only is it educational, and it's not all depressing, it also offers a lot of resources. No matter what anyone does or who anyone is, where they're from, there are wonderful things to learn that you can acquire or change a little bit. Everything from clothing, whether you're a fashionista or you're about to go hiking, there are alternatives to down, there are alternatives to wool. We have fascinating information on the cruelty in the wool trade, which most people have never heard of. And of course, we have super recipes. Alicia Silverstone's cookbook, The Kind Cookbook, is on the web. And we have alternatives to animals and entertainment, to dissection, as I mentioned, pretty much everything. And we will help scientists who are working in laboratories where animals are used find some other more sophisticated way to get that information. We have over 1,000 physicians who help with that.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Ingrid.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Ingrid E. Newkirk, co-founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. For more information, check on the web at PETA.org. Again, that's PETA.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.